From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park area.
Sunset. Portola Valley.
I currently reside in Nob Hill.
West Portal.
I live in Russian Hill.
Coming up, we'll meet farmers fighting climate change with cow poop and saving money, too.
We think it's a win-win for, you know, our pocketbook, and it's a win-win for the environment.
Then, is it possible to be a vegetarian without giving up meat?
We take a biopsy from an animal and we identify the cells in there that are capable of renewing themselves.
We'll head into the brave new world of petri dish meat.
If GMOs bother the American public, I would imagine that lab-grown muscle fiber would really bother the average American.
Join us if you can stomach it. Cross Currents is next. As the new administration questions human involvement in global warming, California is doubling down on its climate policies. In January's State of the State address, Governor Jerry Brown hailed California as a world leader.
We can do much on our own, and we can join with others, other states and provinces, even countries, to stop the dangerous rise in climate pollution. And make no mistake, we're going to do exactly that.
Scientists say that won't be easy, but we'll get there with things like electric cars, conserving water, and dealing with cow poop. KALW's energy and environment reporter Angela Johnston visited the Point Reyes Farmstead Cheese Company to find out more about one unlikely solution to climate change.
Almost nothing goes to waste at this family dairy farm north of Point Reyes Station.
Yeah, we recycle everything that we possibly can on the farm.
Because, says owner Bob Giacomini, this is environmentally friendly cheese. You've heard of curds and whey?
And in most cheese plants, the whey goes down as either a city sewer or into a pond or something. And so we take and feed it right back to our cows.
And their 400 cows even munch on excess brewer's grain provided by beer makers in Petaluma.
We've learned how to feed cattle with a lot of these products, and it's saving me money, and most of all, it's probably doing another good thing for the environment.
And after the cows finish eating, they do what all other mammals do. They poop it out. At most dairy farms, they hose piles of cow manure into a lagoon, where it sits and releases methane, which scientists agree destroys the ozone. But here, methane's just another byproduct of farming that's reused. That's because the Giacominis installed an anaerobic digester. That's a piece of technology they hope will turn all this gassy cow waste into an asset. We walk over to a feeding pen where Giacomini shows me how it works. A conveyor belt brings the manure up from the pit and drops it through a screen, separating the poop into liquids and solids. The solids drop to the ground, and they'll eventually reuse that, too. The liquid gushes into a lagoon covered with thick, black plastic. That turns into a strange-looking balloon, the size of a small house, as the stinky sludge releases methane gas.
We capture the methane. It's pumped off and pumped up to run the engine.
The digester's engine burns the methane gas and converts it into power.
Actually, it goes through the grid. By the grid, it can be fed back to PG&E, or the PG&E can feed this way.
Feed energy right back into their farm. The Giacominis have used the digester for almost a decade, and it's producing electricity to run half their farm. This is pretty unique. Even though milk and dairy are California's top crop, the Giacominis have only one of 16 digesters in the state.
I think that we're going to start to see a shift toward more widespread use, hopefully.
Jeff Greenblatt is a climate scientist at Lawrence Berkeley Labs, who says anaerobic digesters
can definitely lower our overall reliance on natural gas and fossil fuels generally. So it's a really good thing to do.
Digesters can also generate power from food waste, wastewater sludge, and garbage from landfills. Greenblatt says now's the time to address all these methane problems, last summer, the state passed one of the most ambitious climate change bills in the world, SB 32.
And essentially, it's saying that in 10 years, we have to shed 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions for the state.
But it won't be easy. He says we'll have to all start driving electric cars and use electricity to heat and cool our homes. Agriculture will have to change, too. California is the biggest dairy producer in the United States, and cows make up almost half of California's methane emissions.
So wherever we can avoid letting methane seep into the atmosphere, we should.
So when Brown signed that climate bill, SB 32, farmers knew restrictions were coming, and they were right. A few months ago, Brown signed another law requiring dairies to drastically reduce methane emissions by the year 2030. That's a huge ask for dairies. The law provides some funding for methane-busting technologies, like digesters, but not enough, says Michael Bocadoro. He's the executive director of Dairy Cares, a lobbying group.
A large digester can cost, upwards of $10 million in California. You have to figure about $2,000 to $4,000 per cow is a good estimate.
Only 1% of California dairies use digesters, and all of them needed some federal or state funding to build. Even after subsidies, the Giacomini's and Point Reyes paid $600,000 for their digester. And it can cost up to millions just to hook a digester up to the grid.
That's a killer. That project's not going to happen if it's going to cost $3 million to interconnect, just to interconnect it once the digester and generation equipment's built.
Which is why some dairies are toying with the idea of using the methane as truck fuel instead of selling it back to PG&E, or sharing one digester with a cluster of nearby dairies. Some of the funding from the new bill could go to researching these methods. If the state can't strike the right balance with the farmers, Bocadoro says, we'd just be handing part of our methane problem to another state.
So if we have a dairy that simply leaves California and starts producing milk somewhere else, the emissions move with it.
And there's another red flag. Some environmental groups, like the Fresno-based Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, argue the chemicals released when the methane's burned to make energy create lots of problems. Digesters at big dairy and cattle farms in the Central Valley often sit right next to low-income communities. These environmentalists say funding should go towards finding other ways of mitigating methane rather than building more digesters. But this isn't really the case in Marin. Bob Giacomini's farm is small, and there aren't many people living nearby. And he wants to stay put, where his family has farmed for three generations. That's one of the reasons he built the digester. He invested a lot of money up front, but now the digester saves him money on his power bill. And he can charge a little extra for his cheese, he says, because Bay Area shoppers like environmentally friendly products.
Well, anytime you can kill two birds with one stone, that's not too bad, huh? And that's the way we look at it. You know, we think it's a win-win for, our pocketbook, and it's a win-win for the environment.
The new dairy methane bill gives farms until 2024 to make changes. But Giacomini is glad he built his earlier. Now, it's just another part of his farm. For Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
Angela Johnston is KALW's energy and environment reporter. What environmental stories would you like to hear about? Send us an email at environment@klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Meat production uses a lot of water. The numbers vary, but researchers estimate it takes about 600 gallons to produce a single hamburger patty, roughly the amount it takes to fill a backyard swimming pool. So perhaps the best way to save water is by kicking our meat habit. But let's be real here. People in the U.S. eat a lot of beef, an average of 77 pounds per person per year. That's pretty close to a quarter pounder a day. But what if you could produce a nearly identical meat substitute using only a fraction of the water? Our friends at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX looked into it. Here's a story from their host, Al Letson.
So, let's see if I can get in into the lab.
There you go.
Okay, we're in.
Welcome to the new world of lab-grown synthetic meat.
Small demo space, but
Uma Valetti used to be a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic. Now he's the CEO of Memphis Meats. He's an energetic 40-something who looks like he's about to give a TED talk on the future of fake meat. Just don't call it that in front of Uma.
This is not a meat analog or a meat substitute. This is meat.
And it's growing in a lab space above an office depot in a big box strip mall in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a lot smaller and more sterile than your typical cattle ranch. And this is how the meatless industry is raising the stakes. See what I did there? Get it?
So all this is basic lab space where there is lots of, you know, testing that goes on. And then we can go into this room where we can look at some cells.
Okay.
On a stainless steel table, I bend over and look into the microscope.
Yeah.
Now, to my untrained eye, it's just a bunch of speckled, transparent blobs.
So basically, it is these really small little... Oh, wow, I can really see them now.
This is actually how Uma looks at meat on a plate.
When people go to a restaurant and order a steak, that steak is essentially 2 or 3 billion cells sitting on their plate.
Before those 3 billion sizzling cells get plated, they grew inside their mother, were born as calves, raised, and eventually slaughtered. Memphis Meats starts a little differently.
We take a sample, just like if you go to a doctor and take a biopsy, we take a biopsy from an animal, and we identify the cells in there that are capable of renewing themselves. We let the meat grow and know that we can harvest it at a point where it's tender enough. We definitely try a variety of things. We say, let's harvest it at 3 weeks, let's harvest it at 4 weeks, let's harvest it at 6 weeks, and see how it tastes.
Earlier this year, Memphis Meats produced a meatball that took just 1 month to grow.
And now you compare that with the process to actually get a meatball from a beef cattle from the time of artificial insemination, you know, completing the pregnancy, and then letting the animal grow for 12 to 24 months. This process is about 10 to 20 times shorter.
And it takes a lot less water to produce than traditional beef. According to Uma, just 1/10.
So the question I have now is that, like, scalability, right? So, like, right now you guys are pretty small. You're just making, like, 1 or 2 meatballs. How much do those meatballs cost?
So the cost of the meatballs that we showed earlier this year, that meatball cost about $1,000.
Now that is a pricey meatball. I can't believe I just said that. Uma says that as they begin to scale up, within 5 years, they hope to be able to bring the cost down to make their product competitive with ground beef you'd currently find in the grocery store. But the big question is, will it taste good enough to compete? Last year, Memphis Meats released a promotional video for their lab-grown meatball.
You know, this is the first time a meatball has ever been cooked with beef cells that did not require a cow to be slaughtered.
It tastes like a meatball. It's good.
The tester doesn't look entirely convinced. Now, call it the ick factor, but will people get over the creepiness of eating lab-grown meat? Uma's betting they will.
Okay, why is the world not vegetarian? Because people view it as a big sacrifice, giving up meat that they love. The beauty of what we're doing is there's absolutely no sacrifice. They're still eating the same meat, which is identical. And I think when they taste it, they'll absolutely switch over.
Or will they? Now, according to a Pew poll, just 1 in 5 Americans would be willing to eat meat that was grown in a lab. And I wondered how the cattle industry felt about it.
Well, my name is Barb Downey. I'm a full-time cattle rancher in the Flint Hills of northeastern Kansas.
We reached Barb at her ranch.
I've got 20 heifers sitting out here. I can see them just right outside my kitchen window. And we've got a little bit of snow on the ground right now. And the grass that's showing through is this incredible bronze color this time of year. It's really pretty.
Now, Barb recognizes beef takes a lot of water. She says the industry is trying to decrease its water use, do more with less. As for alternatives to homegrown beef,
there's no replacing a good juicy burger or a steak hot off the grill. Beef and a steak brings a whole lot more to the table than just muscle fibers grown in a petri dish.
Barb says she'd like to learn more about the process of growing meat in the lab, and she'd like to sample it. But she also says Americans have some anti-science anxiety when it comes to their food supply. Just take the backlash against genetically modified foods, or GMOs, for instance.
If GMOs bother the American public, I would imagine that lab-grown muscle fiber would really bother the average American.
Uma's petri dish approach is still an experiment, but there's another fake meat recipe that's already being served up. It's a lab-designed ground beef replica made entirely from plants. So I head over to a fancy restaurant, Jardiniere in San Francisco, that's serving up a $16 Impossible Burger. Here's head chef Tracy Desjardins.
This is all made from plants, things that you recognize. It's, you know, soy root nodules, potato protein, coconut fat, vegetable protein that's made from wheat.
Tracy is also a consultant for Impossible Foods, the company that makes the burger. It's come a long way from the veggie burgers you see left over at the end of the barbecue. For one thing, it looks bloody.
Exactly. It does have what is essentially plant blood. It is something that exists in plants, and so it really is the thing that changes, like blood does in meat, and gives you that really savory, meaty flavor that you find in a burger.
The blood is actually something called heme, a molecule that contains iron and oxygen that makes blood red. There's a lot of it in red meat, but it also exists in vegetables, like soybeans. And when we open the packaging...
Yeah, I don't think I would, like, even realize it was a veggie burger.
Yeah, I mean, wait till you taste it, because I think you're really going to be surprised. And also watching it cook, what happens on the grill. So I'm going to go ahead and a little bit of oil on the griddle here. Hear that sizzle?
This glistening, juicy burger uses 1/4 of the water required to produce a beef version from a cow, according to Impossible Foods. So for those of you keeping track at home, one beef burger takes about 34 days of showers. One of these plant burgers, close to 9 days of showers. One of the lab-grown kind, 3 days of showering.
So you can see it changes. You've got, you know, the nice browning that's happening. Just, you know, like a beef burger. I mean, you know, for all intents and purposes, it really does cook the same way. Very, very appealing. Yeah. All right, I'm going to dress this burger up for you.
Tracy puts it on a roll with a few garnishes. And it smells like a burger. She cuts it in half, and it's pink, like a burger. I mean, it's crazy to think, but this entirely plant-based burger is medium rare, just the way I like it.
All right, you ready?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay.
Looks good. Oh, it's good. No, I think if you served this to me, I wouldn't know the difference.
Seriously, I could barely tell. Now, I'd like to think that I have a pretty sophisticated palate, but I wanted to bring this burger to somebody else for some confirmation. So I brought a to-go box back to the office to the bona fide meat lover.
Yeah, a carnivore, like a rampant, bloodthirsty, like bone-gnawing carnivore.
Reveals data reporter Eric Segarra. Now, any day of the week, there's a good chance he's in the office wearing a t-shirt that reads, "Meat is murder, tasty murder." Please send all your emails to Eric.
Well, I should also admit that, like, my girlfriend is a vegan. So you have a guy here who really likes his meat, smokes his own meat, like, cooks with meat as much as possible. And then I have a vegan girlfriend who is not very pleased about the idea that I'm such a carnivorous eater. And so she's actually very excited about these hamburgers, and she wants to try one really badly.
But does it pass the meat lover's test?
So let's see. This, totally pulling it out, it looks like it's even got, like, parts that are even bloody, right? It breaks apart just like ground beef. You know what it probably is you guys probably just gave me some ground beef. Holy cow.
I think that's a pass.
If anything, I would say that, like, it's almost too perfect, right? That's remarkable.
But there was one problem. When Eric showed his vegan girlfriend the bloody plant burger, she couldn't bring herself to eat it. It was too close to meat.
Mm-hmm. This is a tasty burger. I can't usually get them because my girlfriend's a vegetarian, which pretty much makes me a vegetarian. I do love the taste of a good burger. Mm.
That story was produced by Ike Sriskandaraja. It originally aired on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. You can hear Reveal every Monday at 11 a.m. right here on KALW. It's time for Hey Area. That's where we answer a question you ask. This time, KALW's Jürgen Klemm connects a listener with a local historian to learn more about the origins of Mission Creek.
My name is Milena Fiore, and I work here in the Mission District of San Francisco. Where does the river like start from and then go to?
Okay, my name's Ginny Stearns, and I live on a houseboat in Mission Creek. And I think I might be able to help you with an answer about where Mission Creek was and is presently in San Francisco. The Mission Dolores is in the location that it is because it was navigable on Mission Creek from Mission Bay all the way up to the Mission Dolores area. And in fact, water can be seen of Mission Creek underneath the Armory Building on 14th Street and also the Women's Building. So when there's an earthquake, those are the mushiest places. In fact, if you look down Folsom, you can see how the road is kind of a little bit wavy and it's because it's not solid under there.
Do you know, I would imagine that there probably are not plans to daylight it because everything is built now over it?
Well, yes. In some cases, it is channeled off into sewers. There's actually an awful lot of water that's kind of sidelined, which is really kind of a shame that they haven't figured out a way to use it well.
For KALW in San Francisco, I'm Jürgen Klemm.
That piece was part of our Hey Area project. Have you got a Bay Area mystery you want us to solve? Head to our website, kalw.org. And that's it for today's show. Cross Current's production team includes Lila Day, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, James Rollins, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Claire Strempel, and Beatrice Thomas. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. In celebration of St. Patrick's Day this weekend, you may be craving some Irish rock music. We can't offer that, but we can offer the fake meat version of that, a U2 tribute band. Zoo Station, whom you're listening to now, will be performing the U2 album, The Joshua Tree, note for note, on Friday at the Chapel in San Francisco. Doors open at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Give me too much chances. You won't be there.